court will proceed to the third case, Mobile Anesthesiologist versus Anesthesia Association. I'm just wondering if it's So Baron-Holtz will just give it a second to let the crowd disperse.
It's like waiting to serve before, after there's been a change of hands.
They seem to be an orderly crowd, so you may proceed.
No problem. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mark Baron-Holtz. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Mobile Anesthesiologists. We're here today seeking to vacate the Rule 12b-2 dismissal, which the district court entered against my client in June of 2009. In dismissing the action, the district court committed reversible error on the two major issues raised by plaintiff below. Namely, first, and principally, whether the Seventh Circuit's effects test, as enunciated in Indianapolis Colts and Janmark versus Reedy, should apply to defendants' conduct of cyber squatting on plaintiff's federally registered trademark.
Well, as you know, Mr. Baron-Holtz, there is a developing line of personal jurisdiction cases in the country that focus in particular on Internet kinds of contacts, because Internet contacts present difficult problems for our traditional structure of thinking about this. And most of those cases have said, granting the fact that you could be in the middle of Germany and look at both of these websites just as easily as you can from Chicago or from Houston or from Fiji or anywhere else that you can get a connection, we need to think a little more carefully about what is the rule for showing contact, the kind of purposeful availment of a jurisdiction that Hansen against Denkla talks about, and whether it's met here. And yes, Indianapolis Colts is out there, but in what sense did the Houston company, I'm just going to call it the Houston company because your names are, as you were pointing out, similar. What have they done to target the Chicago market at all? They're not offering mobile anesthesia services to Chicago area, even northern Illinois area people. It's this little company in Houston.
I think your question points out the very kind of confusion that the district judge felt when he ruled in the case.
I'm confused so much as talking about what are the relevant factors when you have an Internet case. One option would be to say, as soon as you're on the Internet, you can be sued anywhere on the planet. You can be sued in India. You can be sued in Chicago. You can be sued anywhere because you can look at that website anywhere. Most courts have not adopted that. Most courts have said that's too much. So even though you're present everywhere at the same time. So we're looking for limiting principles. And one of the limiting principles has been passive versus active websites. One of the limiting principles has been the question whether the facts indicate that the allegedly infringing or cyber squatting, whatever website is targeted in any way at people in the jurisdiction. Obviously, you could have gone to Houston and filed this lawsuit, and nobody would be here. You'd be well along the way to adjudicating your Lanham Act rights, but you decided to file it here in Chicago. So we need to find those correct affiliating factors, given that it's an Internet case. So, and I assume you're not arguing for the anything goes approach.
No, we're not. We're asking this court to rule on a much narrower set of factors. And to be more specific with regard to your concerns, the factors at play here are, first, that there is a federally registered trademark. The federally registered trademark
So you could have filed this lawsuit based on the federally registered trademark in Hawaii if you were interested in a nice Hawaiian vacation.
No.
Hawaii's part of the federal government.
No, now you're going too broad with the concept.
Why?
Basically, all we're saying is we want to be able to sue here in Illinois because an Illinois citizen owns the federally registered trademark.
So why are the plaintiff's contacts with the jurisdiction relevant? No Supreme Court case has focused on the plaintiff's contacts with the jurisdiction. Personal jurisdiction is for defendants.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think if we look at Indianapolis Colts and Janmark versus Reedy.
I'm looking at the Supreme Court's decisions, whether it's Worldwide Volkswagen, whether it's Hansen against Denkla, whether it's Asahi Metals, whether it's any of the Supreme Court's cases which say that personal jurisdiction comes from the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, Fifth Amendment, if it happens to be a federal case, and it's about the defendant's personal liberty interest.
But under the Seventh Circuit's effects test, the concerns that are expressed in the Supreme Court decisions are satisfied when the conduct resulting in tortious activity, even commenced outside of the forum state, which in this case is Illinois, result in an injury within the forum state, that means that a tort has been committed within the forum state.
If I recall correctly, Mr. Barinholtz, the Colts decision sort of entertained that idea, but finally said we need not adopt such an austere notion of personal jurisdiction, right?
I did read that sentence in the decision.
Which is pretty important. I was wondering if you could address a case that this court dealt with just after, about a year or so after the Calder case came down from the Supreme Court, Wallace against Heron, which said it was 778 F. 2nd 391, where this court said, in essence, just the fact that you've got a victim of an intentional tort in the forum state is not enough.
I'm sorry, but I'm not familiar with that particular case and on the facts of that case, and I don't believe it was cited in any of the briefs.
It was cited in some of the cases that you cited. But
that may well be the case.
But there are a lot of cases that were cited that way.
If I can just back up a second and get to the trail of analysis that leads me to say that the Seventh Circuit's effects test, in our judgment, should have allowed the district judge to find that personal jurisdiction existed here in Illinois over the Houston defendant. I would say that because there is a federally registered trademark, there are provisions of the Lanham Act, which my client is absolutely entitled to rely on. One of those provisions, or several of those provisions I've cited in my brief, Section 22, Section 7C,
but
states...
But that's substance.
If that argument is right, though, then Congress should have allowed nationwide service of process under the Lanham Act, and it didn't, right?
Exactly.
I'm as curious about how that statute came about as perhaps Your Honor.
Well, it's very clear that that's the law.
There's no national service provision in the Lanham Act.
And so what Congress arguably wants you to do is to enforce the substantive interests that you're talking about in a jurisdiction that has traditional personal jurisdiction, that is to say state law-based personal jurisdiction, over the defendant. And what I'm having trouble finding in this record are what are these effects that you're talking about in Illinois? You mentioned the AMA membership and the anesthesia professional organization.
Those factors don't have anything to do with it. The effect is the harm and potential for harm in damage to my client's trademark.
What harm is there in this record?
The defendant has taken my client's registered trademark and made it the defendant's domain name. The owner of the defendant is operating in the same channel of commerce as my client is, albeit perhaps in a slightly different geographical location, at least for the present. If the defendant is allowed to take my client's domain name, or my client's trademark, and register that as its domain name, what's to prevent him from calling his friend in Minneapolis or someone in Colorado, and before you know it, there's 28 domain names of my client's trademark in them.
Look,
my
client will. I understand the trademark interest. I have no problem. We are talking about the location of the lawsuit for you to assert these kinds of issues, and I don't see where this Houston company has in any way reached out to try to address the Illinois market.
That's where the imputed knowledge provisions of and imputed notice provisions of the Lanham Act come into play as we lead into the requirements of the effects test.
So that's the best you can do. The best you can do is that you're going to impose some sort of constructive knowledge, conceding lack of actual knowledge of anything in Illinois, and that and these couple of trade associations are what links this case, this passive little two-page website that this guy has to Illinois?
Well, first of all, we think constructive knowledge is extremely important, that the statute provides for.
Why does that comply with Hansen's purposeful availment requirement?
Because if the defendant had knowledge.
Constructive knowledge. Defendant doesn't know. The defendant has constructive knowledge, which is a way of saying we're going to treat you as if you have knowledge, even though you don't.
Well, if the statute doesn't mean what it says, then what good is the statute?
You can sue in Houston.
Well, of course we could have sued in Houston, but why should we have to? Why should we be concerned about the cyber squatters' inconvenience?
Well, because of what Judge Hamilton said, because Congress didn't give you unlimited choice.
But here, there's another point at which he did have actual knowledge. We sent him a cease and desist letter and said, guess what?
So that's enough? You send him a letter and then you got jurisdiction? Is that what you're saying?
When he had knowledge that he was affecting an Illinois interest, an Illinois limited liability company, and he knew that there was a federal trademark registration and intellectual property owned by the Illinois resident, and he decided he's going to keep going. He's not. Now I understand. There's a federal trademark registration, and you're an Illinois entity, even assuming I didn't know it before. Now I know it. Guess what? I don't care. I'm going to keep going. Then he had actual knowledge. We sued him several months later. He refused to back down. He refuses to back down today.
Have any cases said that a cease and desist letter is enough to make the difference in jurisdiction?
We didn't cite any cases, but I don't think the defendant cited any cases to the contrary. We've been making that argument since we responded to the motion to dismiss down below. I did have another. We do have another argument. I'm not sure if you have other questions about this particular area. There was a threshold issue in the case below when we came when the defendant came into court. The first thing they did was they made a motion in front of the district judge asking to postpone a preliminary injunction hearing, which we had scheduled. As part of the motion to postpone the preliminary injunction hearing, they indicated that the reason was their witness was not available on that day that the hearing was noticed for, and could we please allow him time to come in and appear. They also asked for an expedited discovery schedule so that they can engage in expedited discovery and prepare adequately for the preliminary injunction hearing. There was not a whisper about the court not having the power to do those things. And, in fact, the defendant treated the district court as if it had power over the defendant and over the request that the defendant was making. 2 weeks later, the defendant comes in and makes a motion to dismiss, saying there's no personal jurisdiction. We think that's a contradiction. We brought a substantial argument below indicating that we felt that that was a waiver and or forfeiture of the right to bring the subsequent, and we felt, tardy motion for lack of personal jurisdiction. If you'll notice in what the order we're seeking review from, which is the two-page order at Appendix B in our brief, the court completely ignores that issue, doesn't even mention waiver or forfeiture. We think that constitutes error. There should have been some ruling. There should have been some consideration of it. It's been addressed by the defendant in its brief, and we feel under the de novo standard.
They didn't make a responsive pleading, did they, when they first came in?
No. They asked to postpone the injunction hearing,
yeah.
And they asked for the right to take expedited discovery. And then we all engaged in a
You believe, Mr. Barinholtz, that amounts then to a waiver of the ability to raise a jurisdiction?
We think by taking those steps and by conceding, in effect, that the court had the power to enter those orders, that the defendant then had waived or forfeited the right to later say, but now we take it back. You don't really have personal jurisdiction over us. You don't have the power to do anything, Judge.
Which of those things do you think made the difference, in your view? Was it just asking for the postponement? Is that a waiver?
I think it could be, but it's certainly buttressed by the fact that they wanted discovery. I would say this, and the cases seem to indicate that if you come into court and you just need a little bit of time to respond, and that's what you're saying is I want an extension of time to respond, the cases seem fairly consistent that that itself doesn't constitute a waiver. But what we're saying is the defendant went beyond that.
But you really had him under the gun, though, right? You went into court, you filed for preliminary injunction in Chicago, you had the district court schedule that hearing very quickly. Why wouldn't anybody want a little opportunity to do a little discovery and prepare for that while you're trying to figure out what your defenses are?
Well, then perhaps they should have said, look, the first thing we're concerned about is that you even have jurisdiction at all. But we're going to address that, and we need time to address that, and in the meantime, we'd like at least a postponement. They didn't do that. They just came in and said, we want a postponement, and we want you to protect us, Judge. Let us take expedited discovery. Push back on this plaintiff. And the defendant had us over a barrel by squatting on our federally registered trademark.
Thank you, Mr. Barinholtz.
I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Ms. Hernandez?
Good morning. My name is Christina Hernandez. I work with the Carter Law Firm in Houston, Texas, and I represent the Appellee Anesthesia Associates of Houston Metroplex, PA.
So, Ms. Hernandez, why don't you start with that latter point, whether your client did enough in this litigation before raising the personal jurisdiction defense to waive it. It is one of those defenses that needs to be raised right away.
Right, and I agree that it is a defense that needs to be raised right away, but specifically the case that was cited by the appellant in their brief, which was the D'Amico v. Treat case, in that case, the court specifically said that Rule 12 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure has abolished the age-old distinction between general and special appearances. So the defendants no longer need to show up or appear specifically to attack the court's jurisdiction.
Well, that's true, but what Rule 12 also says is, in a sense, you know, once you're coming into court, some of the first words out of your mouth have to be, we're objecting to personal jurisdiction. Then you can certainly, without waiving other opportunities to raise other defenses, and I think we can all agree, I actually thought I heard Mr. Barinholtz concede, that merely asking for a little extra time to think is well established as perfectly consistent with your ability to raise a personal jurisdiction issue. Nobody's expecting just silly assertions of the defense before you know. But you all also asked for discovery. So what about that?
With regard to the time that we filed our motion to dismiss based on lack of personal jurisdiction, it was filed within 30 days of service on the defendant.
What other motions did you file? You filed the motion for extra time and the motion for expedited discovery.
We asked for a continuance of the hearing on the preliminary injunction because the only member of my client's association is Dr. Chan, who's an anesthesiologist, and he had surgeries scheduled during the time when the preliminary injunction was going to occur. So we asked for time to ask the court to reset that date. And then in addition to requesting to reset the date, we also asked the court, we knew we were going to have to prepare for this, and it had would have a potentially serious effect on his case. We asked that in preparation for that reset date that we be allowed to conduct discovery so that we would be adequately prepared for the preliminary injunction.
Did you specify anything about the discovery, discovery on personal jurisdiction, or just did you say discovery generally?
It was discovery relevant only to preparation for the preliminary injunction, for the hearing on the preliminary
injunction. But at the preliminary injunction, well, by the time the preliminary injunction hearing happens, you've already raised the personal jurisdiction.
Correct. We filed the, I believe it was within 2 weeks after we filed our request to reset the hearing that we filed our motion to dismiss. And going back to the D'Amico case, one of the issues that the court was, that the defendant was criticized for, was that they believed that the defendant was trying to test the waters to see how the case was going to go prior to filing their motion to dismiss, and that there was some sort of indication that they were misleading the court into thinking that they were going to allow jurisdiction to go forward in Illinois. At no time during the 30 days from the time that the defendant was served and that we filed our motion to dismiss, did the defendant ever allude to or misguide the court or the plaintiff into believing that we were going to allow jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction over the defendant. We didn't test the waters. We didn't have enough time. We were just trying to get our client ready for so that he would not miss this preliminary hearing decide what our strategy was going to be in this case. Hopefully I've answered your question sufficiently with regard to that issue. And I agree with the court. The questions that have been raised, which were the same questions that we've been raising of the plaintiff, is that I understand with the advances in technology that personal jurisdiction issues have to advance as well. But I don't think that the plaintiff has established that it is entitled to bring this case in Illinois against our client.
But here's the as I'm putting together the theory as well as I can, the company Mobile Anesthesiologists has this registered trademark. It's possible to search and find registered trademarks. That's the whole point of the registration. So it was out there, and if your client had been diligent, presumably he would have found that there was this trademark, Mobile Anesthesiologists, and that it was held by a company headquartered in Illinois. And the fact actually that there's even a Houston licensee of this Illinois company suggests that if you adopt a confusingly similar trademark, you could, if not today, then tomorrow or the next day, be harming somebody in Illinois. So the best I can put together, I think that's the theory of Illinois effects. And so the question for you is, let's assume that is the theory, is why isn't that enough?
Well, I don't believe it's enough because, as Judge Norgel stated, the plaintiff was unable to support its empty conclusion that our client intended to injure a plaintiff, an Illinois plaintiff.
So where does subjective intent to injure somebody in Illinois come into personal jurisdiction law?
I believe that that's established in the line of cases, the Janmark case and the Jennings case. I believe the court said that there has to be, it's important where the tort occurs, but it's also important that the defendant aim its business activity or its conduct against the plaintiff in the forum that the plaintiff wants to bring the case in. And here there was no intent. The plaintiff was given an opportunity to take my client's deposition and to conduct discovery to respond to our motion to dismiss based on lack of personal jurisdiction, and was given an opportunity to try to establish where this intent came from and whether it was there. The plaintiff was unable to. There was nothing in the record that supported that our plaintiff knew about the defendant at the time that it registered mobileanesthesia.com, which was the name that his wife chose because she and my client testified to this in his deposition. She said that it sounded cool based on what my client does. They're a fairly young couple. It's a young anesthesiologist. He went to GoDaddy.com and used the name that his wife chose and paid, I think, $1 to register that name. He didn't go and do a search to see if that name was out there. Like the plaintiff has stated, he's trying to establish that my client had constructive knowledge, and by virtue of either that or either by the registration of the trademark or the cease and desist letter that is how the defendant had knowledge of the existence of the federal trademark.
Okay, so there's another theory of or way of thinking about personal jurisdiction. that isn't so intent-based. It doesn't talk about aiming or targeting or that kind of thing. Instead, it talks about putting something in the stream of commerce, and then apparently it floats down the stream and winds up somewhere. The idea is, you know, you've kind of launched a product out there, or perhaps a service, or maybe a trademark, and that would be less intent-based. Do you think that personal jurisdiction in Illinois would be appropriate under that idea?
I believe that if that is the plaintiff's theory, that I believe it fails because my client is not licensed to practice medicine in any other state but Texas. The website, even though it does go to mobileanesthesia.com and it brings up his business, it's a two-page website, and it specifically states that this company serves the greater Houston Metroplex area. During his deposition, he stated that he had no intent, or he didn't even imagine that he would be being contacted by any other by patients in any other state except for Texas, because he knew he wouldn't be able to treat them. So if he's putting his services in the stream of commerce, it was specifically within Texas, and more specifically within the greater Houston area.
Well, in addition to the geographic location, did the website indicate that the doctor is licensed only in the state of Texas?
No, it did not. It states, I believe, that it is that it serves the greater Houston area. I don't know that it has anything specific that says that he's not licensed in any other state but Texas.
Is that common in medical websites, like it is in, I assume, legal websites, where one is able to practice is normally listed?
I don't know if that's common or not. I do know from the testimony that my client has given is that he started the website, was able to finish two pages, which basically just give information about what the company does, has his email address, has his cell phone number, and then it says, you know, still under construction, we'll update later.
So this is all these things that you've appended to the
brief? Yes, the appendix C to the appellant's brief are the two pages of my client's website. And I agree with Judge Norgel, I guess just to summarize, I don't know if there's any other questions, but I think the consequences of ruling in favor of the appellant in this case is very serious, especially because of what the judge said earlier, was that you can access a website in any state here in the United States and anywhere in the world. And it would just seem to really open the floodgates for plaintiffs to be able to bring a case against any defendant in any forum simply by the fact that that defendant's website can be accessed in any place. And there's specific case law out there that says that that is not allowed. You cannot bring a lawsuit against the defendant in a specific...
What if one searched Mobile?
I'm sorry?
What if one searched the word Mobile and medicine, let's say? Mm-hmm. Would that have been a responsible thing to do before launching?
And I actually did that when we first heard about this case. I Googled mobile anesthesia, and my client's website did not come up. The appellant's website came up, and their domain name is zzzdoctor.com or something like that. So because of the fact that I guess they've registered or created their website through another company other than GoDaddy.com that only charges you $1 for a domain name, if you actually Google those two words, their website comes up before ours does. So, I mean, any sort of inference that we're competing with this Illinois company is pretty ridiculous, in our opinion. If you don't have any other questions, I'll...
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Barinholtz, your time had expired, but you may have another minute to respond.
I think it's critical for the court to keep in mind when you're talking about Hansen versus Danklow or International Shoe or Gray versus American Radiator, and all of the different kinds of personal jurisdiction cases, that what we're dealing with here is the Anti-Cybersquatting Consumer Protection Act. It's a very special provision of the Lanham Act. We're also dealing with a federally registered trademark.
and the special rules that go along with the federally registered trademark. And we're putting those factors together with the effects test under the Seventh Circuit's authorities. That would should result in a very narrow decision by your honors stating that personal jurisdiction is appropriate here over the Houston defendant because of the convergence of these unique factors.
Unique about those? It sounds like what you're arguing for is nationwide jurisdiction for intentional violations of a federal statute generally.
No, we're not.
What's special about these?
All we're saying is that Mobile Anesthesiologists is an Illinois entity that owns a federal trademark registration. Its intellectual property and the brunt of the injury that it is suffering here in Illinois is felt in Illinois. Illinois is a proper forum within which to assert jurisdiction over the defendant. We're not saying we can assert federal jurisdiction over the defendant anywhere else.
Why wouldn't that be true of an environmental regulation, an employment statute, healthcare regulation, anything you care to name? If a plaintiff is alleging an intentional violation somewhere else in the country of a federal statute that hurts him at home.
I'm not sure I understand your question. But
I'm asking for what's unique about the cyber squatting or trademark aspects of
this. We haven't been able to find any case in this circuit, and I'm not sure that there is one nationwide, where these, and perhaps it's because the effects test may not be in existence per se in the same fashion as it is here in the Seventh Circuit, where these combination of factors exist. We're asking the court to vacate the dismissal and allow this case to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barnhold. Thank you, Ms. Hernandez. The case is taken under advisement.